Welcome into Spinning a Yarn's Tale, a fiber arts podcast about culture and history, brought to you by You and I Yarns in Chehalis, Washington. My name's Blair.
I'm Denise.
And welcome on in. This week we're going to be talking about the history of kind of fiber arts. It's a general history, not anything too in-depth. But before we get started on that, why don't you introduce yourself? Give us a little intro so we know who you are. Get familiar.
All right. My name's Denise. I enjoy fiber arts, and that includes knitting, crochet, weaving. Besides that, I like to stay active, be outside, work out, and then I also like nature. How about you, Blair?
Well, my name's Blair. I like long walks on the beach, good food, and romantic movies. Just kidding. I'm really into fiber arts. I spin, I knit, I crochet. Along with that, I really like to draw. I like to draw a lot. And that's about it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you want to get started?
Yeah, let's get started. Where do you think would be a good spot to start?
Well, since we're talking about fiber arts, I think a good place to start is the history of domesticating sheep.
Ooh, I know a bit about that one. Mm-hmm. Because even though yarn can be made out of a number of things, and there's historical evidence for a number of different types of fiber, when people think of knitting or working with yarn, they think of wool. So starting with sheep is the most logical place to kind of begin our journey. And so I think it's important to mention the domestication of sheep.
Yeah.
Sheep used to be kind of nomadic. They would wander, kind of like, you know, like buffalo in the United States. They would wander around from season to season to find the places with the best food.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And they would stay there and then move on. And people would kind of like follow these nomadic patches, herds of sheep. And eventually, and I'm just going to say it's one guy for the sake of making it easy. One guy was like, huh, I kind of wish they would just stop moving. And so we don't have to like chase the fluff around fields, because the sheep would naturally shed their coat in the spring. And that's what people would use. They would kind of just pick it up after it had been dropped. And so following around these sheep was important so you could get the most yield out of one sheep. And so this guy was like, oh, God, I wish they would just stop moving so we didn't have to, like, move with them every time they, like, wanted to go somewhere. And so he domesticated them. They kind of just, like, started holding them in pens, big, big pens, attached to, like, cities. And it wasn't, like, one person's sheep. It was more like a city sheep. So people would come together and everybody would have the communal fiber, basically. They would shear the sheep eventually, because with the domestication of sheep and keeping them in one place came the really brilliant thought of this one guy, yet again. Hey, I wish they would just like stop shedding it so that we could control when we get it all at once. And it's kind of one of the earliest examples of selective breeding. Because he would take a sheep that wouldn't shed their coat, and then he would take a sheep that would, and he would breed them and hope that the babies wouldn't shed their coat. And that's kind of how it happened. We bred out the need for shedding coats. It became more of a, we shear them every year type thing. And it's neither here nor there ethically. Some people will say it's a bad thing. I, for one, think it's pretty great. But
people like to be in control.
People like to be in control. And it gave us a very stable source of clothing. Because they would take this and they would weave with it and they would knit with it and they would make clothing with it. And it was warm in the winters, cool in the summers. And it was readily available. And a lot less work to process than, say, a flax, where you have to hackle it to bits for it to be even like,
oh yeah,
usable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the birth of the domestication of sheep. And with that came the birth of the sheepdog, which was people saw wolves herding sheep, and then they were like, oh, my little dog Fido, he could do that. His babies could do that, I think. And they started selectively breeding.
Was that the same guy?
Dogs. Oh, yeah. That's just this one guy. Over thousands of years. He's a vampire.
Nice.
He lived forever. And that's kind of where wool started. And it was in ancient Mesopotamia, anywhere from around 11,000 BC to 8,000 BC.
That's super long ago.
It is very, very long ago.
Yeah.
It might be even older than my grandma.
What?
I know, crazy.
So, even though these sheep had been domesticated so long ago, the first fragments of knitting that we found are, like, from the 7th to 9th century AD, which is, like, so much later. And these fragments were not even garments. They were just, like, little snippets of knit stitches, I guess. And that's what archaeologists base their first knitting material on and what they know about knitting. So we didn't have stockings yet back then. It was just fragments of knitting. And from these fragments and from the stitches that we saw in these little pieces of fabric, it showed us that the knitting culture had already been established way before the 7th or 9th century, because there was a lot of technique and a lot of sophistication to the fabrics. So that's really cool to know, and also a good reminder that the things that we find on the earth right now aren't necessarily like the first fragments that have existed of knitting.
Yeah, it kind of pre-existed us all, and somewhere in there there's also null binding, and of course there's weaving. Weaving has been around for centuries, if not millennia, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's really cool to see that, like, all of these fragments, all of these fragments can be found, and we can still pull knowledge from them. Like, for example, there's this one blue and white cotton sock. It's a beautifully intricate, wonderfully made sock that's found in Egypt, because a lot of early knitting is actually found in the Middle East and places like Egypt and Israel and Afghanistan and places like that. They wore a lot of knitting, or like knit garments, because for one, it kind of ties into why in biblical times, Jesus wore garments that could not be separated because they were knitted in one piece. And that date backs way, 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 way back. But, like, these people, they knit a beautiful indigo and white sock out of cotton. And cotton has been around for centuries, like I said. And it was the easiest fiber for them to have. And it's cool. It's airy. And it allows your skin to breathe. And these socks were really, really interesting, because they were sandal socks, so they were made to keep people's feet protected from, one, the sand, two, the sun, and three, for anything that might be in the sand, so critters, bugs, anything like that. And this sock is a wonderful example of how intricate all of those, that knitting could be. And it's got a gorgeous cuff, and it's made with a twisted stitch pattern. It's knit in the round, and it has an afterthought heel. So the heel was knit separately and then added on so that people could, like, remove the heel when it got worn out. It was very, very, very in-depth and amazing, because you think of an afterthought heel and you're like, oh, I do that in my socks, and it must be kind of like a modern thing that somebody thought up. No, it's been going on since, like, Egypt. In the 12th century, they had afterthought heels. It was crazy.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It is.
And they had a lot of color work on there, too.
That was
a pretty intricate design as
well.
It was
a gorgeous, gorgeous design.
Yeah.
Lots of geometric shapes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very beautiful.
And this was, from looking at the sock, I think it was made by someone who didn't necessarily wear a lot of sandals outside. Because a lot of sandal socks of the time actually were split. so that you had your big and your second toe in one little alcove, kind of like toe socks, and then the rest of your toes would be in like a second piece, so that the thong of the sandal could fit through and go in through your big and your second and big toe. And hey, no blisters, you're wearing socks. Socks and sandals predate Birkenstocks.
No kidding.
Hey, nice. if people in Egypt could do it, I can do it today.
Yeah, I do it all the time.
Well, I don't really wear Birkenstocks, but I wear Crocs.
Oh, that counts.
It counts. Kind of. And I mean, like, socks and stocks aside, we know that knitting started in the Middle East. We found the most bits and pieces there. But it didn't stay there, you know? It had to have moved somewhere. And it kind of moved west?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah. During the Crusades, which was a big, big migration of a lot of Arabian people, I guess, knitting came to Spain and France. So once knitting came to Spain, a lot of people started knitting for the Catholic Church there, which was a pretty elitist type thing to do. And then from there on, artisan guilds were formed. So men would join these guilds, these knitting guilds, and make knitting art, which was definitely on a different level than any of the, you know, practical knitting of sweaters or things like that. These men mostly made rugs and beautiful robes and stuff like that. And actually the first knitting guild that we know of is established in France in 1268 already, pretty early on in the knitting history, if you will. And then by the 15th century, all knitting guilds were also a thing in Spain and in the Netherlands. And for these knitting guilds, it was usual for young men or apprentices to make four masterpieces, including a rug and I think a beret, that would admit them into the knitting guilds. And like from then on, they would kind of be taken seriously.
But there was no women here, right?
There were no women in knitting guilds. No, no.
The women were stuck with the practical knitting, huh? None exactly. of the fun stuff.
Yep. None of the Rude. Fun stuff. Yep.
That's where you get those stories where women dress up as men, you know?
Yeah.
And like, because they have stuff they want to do.
I would knit myself a male robe and then and then join a guild.
I would just shave my head.
Yeah. Why hey, not?
Let me in. I knit all this cool stuff. But that didn't really happen. Not at least not, that we know.
Yeah, not. But it would have been cool. Of. Yeah, but women were knitting for practical reasons,
mm-hmm.
and even in convents, women were knitting. The nuns.
Yeah, because around the 14th to 15th century in the Tudor period, people were really, really into convents because it was the way that the church spread its power, right? So people would set up these huge churches, like every town had one, and these convents would rent out their land, and that's where tenant farming came from. Mm. And so tenant farming was the birth of people knitting in convents, because a lot of these farmers would have sheep. Because, one, they needed wool for themselves, two, they would sell it to the convent, and then three, the convent would then sell it off to other people and keep the best stuff for themselves to knit for the needy and stuff like that, you know. It's always been around.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people would come to convents to learn to knit too. The nuns would teach people. They would teach children and women, and they would also have like missions. First I should explain what a mission is. Missions are when people go out and they convert people to Christianity, Catholicism, whatever. And they would teach people from different countries how to knit. And that's kind of how it spread from there. Convents were really big in the spread of knitting. And it was just kind of like this really cool thing that ended so soon. And because the convents and the fall of the church and, you know, things like that.
Life happens.
Sometimes the churches don't exist anymore. I'm not big into theology, so I can't tell you why. But these tenant farmers were really important to the growing of wool in the Tudor era in France, in Spain, in Europe, England, everywhere. And it just kind of went from there. We have interesting evidence from knitting in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. and how to identify that people were knitting in times like that. One of them is some very cool paintings.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, there's a series of paintings, honestly, from the Middle Ages called, they call it the Knitting Madonnas right now. And they are pictures of Mary, Jesus' mother, knitting a garment, presumably for Jesus himself. And there's a lot of interesting observations that we can make from these paintings that might tell us more about the knitting culture and tradition that existed in the Middle Ages. And again, we got to be cautious here because, you know, these paintings were also art. So who knows what the artist put in there that was real life and what was, you know, part of what he thought was beautiful.
It's a lot of inference.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. But, you know, it's what we have to go on. So that's kind of why people still really refer to these paintings a lot.
Yeah, like Mary knitting on double-pointed needles.
Yeah,
when
that's a big
deal.
When
did double-pointed needles go from needles with hooks on the end to double points, which we'll get to later.
Yeah, exactly. And how knitting in the round was more of a thing than knitting flat.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's the what you said earlier about the garment of Jesus not being able to be broken.
Yeah.
Because it was seamless and knit in the round. So that's one of the things that you can see on the paintings is the double-pointed needles were already a thing back then, apparently. And then also the fact that women were knitting, which, mm-hmm. again, the knitting guilds were mostly men or exclusively men. So, but apparently women were also knitting. And
in some of the pictures, there's color work even present.
Yeah.
Some of them have Mary knitting from, like, three different balls of color. So color work existed back then.
Which is amazing because the garment is red, but the balls of yarn are, like, purple and green and whatever.
They're going to be for the cuff, okay? Jesus is going to have a pretty cuff. Okay?
I am really interested in what the painter was thinking.
Maybe he just was like, yeah, women, they knit this. I see my mom using three balls of color. That's what Mary would do. Yeah. She's also a mom.
Exactly. So and like, what's interesting, too, is that Mary is in it. She's blonde, and she's in like a medieval garment instead of, you know.
What they would be wearing in the time of Jesus.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
It's like the third century BC. I don't know.
No.
I'm not good at this.
Yeah, like. Exactly zero, year zero.
Year zero.
But anyway, yeah, so the knitting Madonnas were a big deal. And if you can Google them, I would highly suggest doing that at home.
The art is astounding. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
We'll put some links in the show notes to a couple pieces, as well as all of our references that we used in this episode.
Yeah.
So those will be there for your enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. And then to shift gears a little bit, we can talk about silk and how that's been introduced into Europe and how that's used in garments.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, everybody knows that the Silk Road existed. It predates when it was used knitting. Because the Silk Road was, I think it was established in 1200, the 12th century?
Could be.
11th century? It was very old. It was very, very old. And it was the main way that China exported and imported prices through the land to Europe and across all of those different countries. And one of those things was silk. Silk was very big in China. very drapey, in a lot of clothing. And it came to us, and we were like, oh, it's very fine. It's very beautiful. It has this gorgeous luster. And people used it in weaving for the longest time. But from that, it kind of grew into, well, if you can weave with it, you can knit with it, right?
Yeah.
And fine things like silk knit stockings and silk knit shirts became a thing. And it was just kind of, it became more of a fad. And in that time, that was around the 1500s, knitting became more of a thing rich women did than a thing that was done out of necessity. A lot of women still knit out of necessity because we're before the Industrial Revolution. It's still more worth it to knit your own clothes. Mm-hmm. But things like lace became something that rich women did. It was kind of found in around 1562 is the first evidence we have of the purl stitch. It was found on a piece of Eleanor of Toledo's garments. It was kind of like where knitting kicked up to a fever pitch almost, because you had the birth of modern lace as we know it. It wasn't as intricate as some of the patterns that come after it, but it's still the start of lace. And that's when things start really progressing. We know color work's been around forever. People have been knitting color work since
Mary.
Before Mary. it was in those socks found in Egypt. It's been around forever, but this was something new and something fun. And it's kind of where the rich women would knit lace, the average woman would knit for her family. And sometimes they would make pretty things because, you know, people wanted to be in fashion. They wanted what the rich people had. It's kind of how it always goes. It's still that way. Everybody wants Supreme, even though it's kind of ugly. Mm-hmm. But that's neither here nor there. But that led into, like, a lot of really cool techniques that are found. A lot of them are not necessarily knitting, but it follows into felting. But that's something you know more about than I do, Denise.
Yeah, I actually read quite a bit about berets in France. That those flat hats that stem from the Middle Ages and are still used today in like military organizations and stuff like that.
Like the green berets.
Yeah, the green berets, tan berets.
Oh yeah.
And all these berets are felted. So what that means is that, which to me is really strange, they would knit the beret. So mm-hmm. they would use their needles, they would knit the whole thing, and then they would dye it and felt it at the same time. And they would just leave it to soak for about 5 days.
And did they agitate it? Kind of like stir it?
Yeah, they probably stirred it and used hot water to felt the fabric. And so the fabric was knit, and the felting would hide all the stitches. Which to me is really odd because you spend so much time knitting on it.
And today we just value like stitch definition, you know? Yeah. Everybody's like, ooh, this yarn has a beautiful stitch definition. And yeah. Back then they were like, no.
Felt it.
Put it away. Get rid of it. I don't want it.
Yep. Yeah. And then once it was dyed and felted, they could actually shape it and cut it as well, because you wouldn't cut through any of the stitches. So that's why that was like a useful technique in those days to get it to fit to somebody's head.
That could also go for like garments too. They could felt like a sweater, and if it was too big, they'd just cut it up the side.
Yeah, cut it up, or it would shrink by itself, or you could block it a little bit better.
That's really interesting. Because yeah. Like when we think about it today, no one would dare like felt their sweater.
Yeah.
No one would dare do anything like that, but it makes sense. Because then if it doesn't quite fit, because patterns don't exist yet, you just cut it up the side and like sew it closed around someone.
Yeah.
And then it fits.
Yeah.
And your stitches don't go anywhere because it's felted.
Yeah, exactly.
That's genius.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know with like actual berets for like the military, the soldiers have to shave it off. So it's like it becomes a really thin fabric. But then they can also shape it to their head so it actually fits. So they wet it and they kind of felt it, I guess, or re-block it.
And that's modern?
That's still happening today. But, you know, that used to happen back in the day, too.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And this fabric would be more waterproof. So, I mean, these people didn't have raincoats when they were out in the field shepherding or whatever. So they would wear their berets.
Yeah, nylon didn't exist yet. Plastic didn't exist yet.
No, not really.
Raincoats.
Exactly.
Bellies weren't a thing, you know?
Exactly.
Oh, so that makes sense. Because when you don't have the holes that the stitches have in like a knit hat, none of the rain gets through. It kind of bounces off because wool is naturally water wicking.
Yeah, exactly. Like wool is really helpful in that respect, and you don't have those open little gaps of the knit stitches. Yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah. And then from there, we're already kind of touching on like nylon and stuff like that. Eventually, the knitting frame was invented in the 16th century. And from there, industrial knitting kind of.
Yeah, stuff. From there, things just kind of like pick up. You go like 200 years where people are making things, right? And they think this is the best knitting can ever be. And then the Industrial Revolution hits. Before that, they made the knitting frame, like you mentioned. And that sped up knitting substantially. And when I say knitting frame, I think of, I want you to think of like a modern knitting loom. So they were either square or they were rounded, and people would knit socks or like hats or anything on them. And not so much round as in round, but like ovular. They were oblong. And they were huge. They were huge. So people could knit big swaths of knit fabric, take it off the loom, felt it, like you mentioned, and cut that up into clothing. But from there, people got rid of the felting bit in the Industrial Revolution with the invention of the knitting machine. So the knitting machine comes, and it kind of wipes out the need for home knitting. And not that it didn't still exist. Women still knitted for practical reasons, but it kind of wiped out the knitting businesses that people had, because women would knit for money. But with the invention of the knitting machine, it kind of like beat them out. Mm-hmm. It was cheaper and it was faster to run a machine than it was to pay for somebody's handwork.
Yeah.
And that just kind of like grew. And then after that, the Industrial Revolution in 1816, it kind of in the midst of it actually, there was the birth of the CSM, the circular sock machine, which was really important in the World Wars. It was because women were encouraged to knit socks, but because home knitting had not been a thing for such a long time, people didn't know how to knit socks. They didn't know how to make them fit. So these people with their hearts in the right place, very
bless
much
them.
Bless them. You were trying so hard, sweetie. They would knit socks that wouldn't fit anyone. The feet would be like like 2 feet long, and the leg would be like an inch. It was just like, whose foot is fitting in here? Not mine. And that brings about the whole conversation about how they hired people to professionally unpick and re-knit socks to send out. But the government, because they were losing so much money on giving people wool and having messed up socks come out of it, they kind of just started handing out circular sock machines to people and being like, we will give you the wool. We will give you the machine. Please just knit socks and don't make them weird. Don't make them weird.
Don't change anything about the
just
machine.
Here's a pattern. Just close the toe up and send it to us. Like, come on. And that's kind of like where knitting inventions kind of stagnate. Not that we haven't had knitting inventions. I mean, like the birth of brioche, anyone? Hello. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. The birth of a table loom, the birth of like modern spinning wheels. It kind of just like, for knitting, it stagnates there. But then you get into knitting tools. And that's where we're kind of winding down on this. The birth of knitting, like, we're going to go back in time. And we have knitting needles that started as two needles with hooks on the end. Kind of like crochet. And people would use those. And that started in the Middle East, of course, where the birth of knitting is from. No matter what anyone says, no, Scotland, you did not make knitting. It was made in the Middle East. That's kind of where knitting needles started. And somewhere in there, knitting needles developed, and they kind of threw away the hook. But not completely, because, you know, crochet exists. But knitting needles didn't need it anymore. And then somewhere in there, and it's really foggy, because there's no one way to pin where it was made, who made double-pointed needles, but double-pointed needles came into the world, and that's where round knitting came. And it just kind of, like, grows from there,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, if you think about it, because knitting is one of those things that, yeah, we have knitting machines now, but a home knitter is most often still limited to just their needles.
Mm-hmm.
And there's developments in knitting needles, but they're still the same old knitting needles, same principle as so many years ago.
Yeah, I mean, like, we had the birth, like, we came around to circular knitting needles, and we don't even know where those started, but we have, like, a patent from 1918 in the USA, but people were probably using them before then. We just don't know about it. And it's really hard to kind of, like, pull all that information in. And with things like weaving and spinning, it's hard to pinpoint where they started, because spinning was a thing everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
People had drop spindles.
Yeah.
People in China had, like, I think some of, like, the first tower wheels, like the castle wheels.
Yep.
Because they're walking wheels. You didn't walk. You sat on the floor, and the spindle was above your head, and you would spin the wheel with your arm, kind of like a charka, but upright. And a charka, to go on that, is a flat spinning wheel where you turn a knob and you just pull the fiber and spin it onto a spindle. And it's hand operated, no feet. Feet treadling came around, I want to say, the 17 to 1800s. And weaving, oh God, weaving's so old. Because you have things like backstrap looms and weighted looms where a lot of Norse people had rocks they would just find that were kind of like similar in weight, and they would attach them to weigh down their warp, and then they would weave. And it's just like, it's a lot of it is so old, and we can't pinpoint and kind of lead a path as easily as we can through knitting.
Mm-hmm.
Certain things like weaving with silk started with the Silk Road and ended with the Silk Road. Not quite. Because it just took longer and it became more scarce, because then they had to go to the ocean, because one country got mad at China and said, no more trading. But it just kind of, it's hard. And I think that's the kind of the point we want to leave on, is that though we're going through a brief history of knitting, it's not the definitive edition of the history of knitting.
Yeah,
it's kind of just what we understand from reading and being knitters ourselves.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that our history doesn't make any sense, but it's just so hard to pinpoint certain things in knitting. But the things that we went over today kind of bring together the knitting that we know today, I think.
Yeah, it kind of tied up a lot of loose ends for me.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, like, I've sat there and wondered, God, who decided to knit a sock one day? Well, it was somebody in the Middle East.
Yeah.
They didn't want the sand to touch their feet, and they didn't want blisters from their flip-flops. Like,
stocks and socks. Do we still call them flip-flops?
Well, I know people in Australia call them thongs, but thongs are a different thing in America.
Yeah, I don't.
So I don't really feel comfortable calling them thongs. Might cause some confusion. So it's a flip-flop.
It's a flip-flop. We've decided.
The onomatopoeia is better. Flip-flop. It's true. Hey. It's got different... And I guess that also joins in that terms are different. Just terms for things are vastly different across countries.
Wasn't it slippers?
No, they're sandals.
Oh, sandals. Yeah, that's a flip-flop too, right?
But sandals can also be Birkenstocks.
Yeah, that's true.
So, like, stocks and socks, yeah. But they were wearing flip-flops, so it was flops and socks? I don't know.
Yeah.
The socks stay on.
Yeah.
It's all that matters.
Yeah, no thongs.
No. None of that. But I think that's kind of where we want to leave off, because from here, we're going to dive into kind of what Europe has to offer us in terms of knitting. We've kind of given you a light catch up to speed on what knitting is and where it came from. And now we're going to move forward to individual kind of cultures.
Yeah.
So what people in England did, how it developed there, how that's different from places in, like, Spain, Germany, Sweden. And it's just kind of, we're going to meander our way through.
Yeah, and even how, like, an island of the same country can create a completely different knitting tradition than the mainland.
Oh, yeah. Well, even, like, two of them. Scotland. You got Shetland and you got the Faroe Isles.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much to explore in knitting.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot.
It's exciting.
I hope you'll stick around and listen to us kind of make our way through.
Go on tangents.
Stumble our way through.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. So the next time we'll see you is in
2 weeks.
2 weeks? 2 weeks from now. 2 weeks from now. And with that, my name is Blair.
My name is Denise.
And thank you for listening to Spinning a Yarn's Tale.